Has there been any plans yet for a bottom survey of the vessel?
Yes, we have divers out there right now.
Okay.
The dive.
Well, Don Neal, we're going to water construction on an anchorage. We were on the Swallow incident out of Dutch Harbor. One of the first things we did was determine the extent of the damage to the bottom of the vessel. Probably should be, you are on it now, and that's...
Yes, we have. I understand there's a diving group that, when I was coming over here, it was on its way to the ship. So that's clearly one of the first things we want, and they'll be taking underwater videos, and we'll know a lot more when we get those.
Available here, right?
Okay, I'd like to talk to you.
How many more skimmers are available on the West Coast to get this thing started on skimming it now? You know, how many are available?
Two, yeah. Well, we are bringing in four from London and one skimming system from San Francisco. The way it's spreading, I don't think skimming is the answer, clearly. If we had...
Protect our environment, it's front of the bay and the families in the garden, in my opinion. To protect the environment, it's already out there. We need to protect the bays. Major bays need to be skimmed.
I agree totally with you. And, you know, if you have a representative that would like to point out the most environmentally sensitive, we have a lot of that already pre-planned. Good. We'll be working with the state agencies.
We're waiting to go to work. Get something going in the morning.
Yes, sir. Tonight.
Yes, on the cause of the accident, I know you can't comment, but what do you feel of reduced crew sizes and more fatigue on the people that run the ships? And secondly, did you receive a letter from a Mr. Spencer or a Mr. Hillman representing the Exxon Siemens Union within the last 2 weeks after the spill in Hawaii, suggesting that reduced crew sizes may cause accidents in the future?
I didn't receive any letter. There now is a government study going on. It's sponsored by the Coast Guard through the National Research Council, which is looking exactly into the question of the relationship between crew size and safety. That study is due to conclude about the end of the year, with the full report coming out probably around the April 20th, or around April of next year. You know, the spill, it's hard to say. This vessel has a crew of 20. And as far as I can tell, there's no circumstance that would indicate the crew size had anything to do with it. If we had 80 people on there, that would be just 60 more we'd have to try to get off. You know, the incident of the casualty, as far as we can tell, is not related to crew size. There clearly was something went wrong. It was not with the operation of the vessel, the mechanical operation, because she was fully operational at the time that she grounded. So we need to dig in and understand exactly what it was, but I can't see any connection with crew size. Yes.
Sir, was it your impression that the Coast Guard was monitoring the departure of this ship with its sophisticated radar, and what happened?
I believe there is a VTS system for Valdez, and I know the vessel was in contact with the Coast Guard, because they have to ask for permission to depart from the outbound lane, and that was granted. So there was some communication going on between the Coast Guard and the vessel.
Was there any warning by the Coast Guard that the ship was so far outside of the lane?
I don't know. Don't know. But certainly we'll need to get into all that. Yes? Well, as far as we can tell, everything on the ship was operational. There was no rudder failure. There was no power failure. So I think we would need, when we get into it, we will need to address the actions in navigating the vessel. And certainly we'll look to all the equipment to make sure we understand its condition. But at this point, everything all the indications we have is that the vessel's fully operational. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hierathi, I'm afraid that you're generating more questions than you're answering.
That usually happens.
You mentioned that Exxon is assuming all financial responsibility for this spill, which I think is a very positive step. But I would also like to point out that after the majority of the spill is cleaned up off the water, and it looks like there's no more oil around, that the oil can be down in the water column, and the fisheries resources can still be affected weeks after the spill looks like it was cleaned up. Now, I am interested to know whether your company is going to cover our fisheries resources if, when the herring fishery opens and our fishermen deliver to the local processors, and I'm assuming we're going to have a DEC person there, if the DEC person discovers that hydrocarbons have been stored in the lipid levels of the herring, which would be the herring roe, which is what we're trying to market this time of year, hydrocarbons are collected and stored in lipids.
I said we would assume full financial responsibility. I didn't put any qualifications on it.
Okay, so there's...
If it's a claim that is associated with the spill, we've assumed full financial responsibility.
We're worried that not only our creeks will be affected, but also the fisheries resources could potentially be affected weeks after it looks like the spill was.
Well, we would be just as concerned as you are, so we'll be talking a lot with you and making sure that all the checks are necessary. We aren't going to be leaving for a long time.
Do you have any financial estimate of possibly the value of this incident at this point?
No. Having mobilized half the cargo planes in the world just 3 weeks ago, I can tell you that's an expensive piece of the activity. Yes, sir.
Could you outline your task force plan of attack as far as mobilizing and news releases and what you're going to do for the local people as far as employment and utilizing the facilities here locally?
The task group itself will be comprised of these 40 people that I said, some of them you might call managing activities, others are supervisors of more specific activities, and then we've got six or eight scientific advisors who have different expertise. And they'll be handling different facets of it. One major activity that will be going on within that is any kind of beach cleanup or shoreside cleanup. And there are two people who will be managing that activity, and they will be calling on and attempting to mobilize whatever resource they need. And certainly we would look to you all to be right in the forefront of that.
What would it cost to
Still don't know. My guess is it'll be around $3 million plus or minus $1 million. Most of the cost, the biggest cost item in that that particular spill was mobilizing an awful lot of equipment. Very fortunately, we didn't need any of it because the spill, rather than being at the magnitude we initially thought, turned out to be a total of 2,800 barrels. I'm sorry, 800 barrels. Total spill was 800 barrels. 600 it came from the cargo hose at the terminal, and 200 it came from the ship. And we initially thought the spill was at least 2,800, but after the assessment on the ship, that was downgraded to 800. And we had half the response equipment in the world mobilized for 800 barrels. And that probably was over one-third of the total cost, just getting the airplanes in the air, half of which we turned back before they got to Hawaii. But you know, in a situation like this, what you have to do is mobilize all the resource you can. because you have to make sure you're ready for any eventuality. And we're certainly not going to spare any cost in doing that. Yes, sir.
Valdez is notoriously difficult to fly in and out of. What, are there any contingency plans in place if the weather comes in and we can't fly in or out of here for the next few days?
Well, we'll be getting most of the equipment in by tomorrow morning, so we need to be lucky for about 12 hours or so. The dispersants will the current plan, and it may change, the fellows are up there firming up these plans, but at least as I left and came here, our plan was to operate the dispersants out of Anchorage. So the dispersant activity will be coming out of Anchorage. Well, we have authority to test and to begin to use dispersants, and of course what you do is you address that with one application, and then you have to determine the effectiveness of it. There's no sense in spraying if it's not effective. Very, very moderate amount of turbulence. You do need some agitation, but not too much. So again, I'm not an expert on dispersants.
When do you think the dispersant test will occur, and how long after that before you know
where you're going to go? The plane is due in, and it has the dispersant equipment. It's a C-130, and it also has a load of dispersant. So it's due in about 6 o'clock in the morning. I think what we'll do is land it here in Valdez and get ourselves ready for the first application. We need to put a helicopter up in the air. The helicopter essentially directs the plane, and then the helicopter will be monitoring the effectiveness. So, you know, I'd say as fast as we can turn that plane around, maybe an hour or so, we have it in the air, and I'd say that, you know, by mid-morning we ought to know how effective it's going to be. Yes, sir.
Someone earlier asked about an error in that the ship was fully operational. Can we assume then you are investigating human error and that is the most likely cause? What other cause could it be?
Well, I'd hesitate to really pinpoint it at this point. We need to go at it with a pretty open investigation, which does not make any presumptions going in. I could say at this point we've had no indication of any mechanical or electronic failure, none whatsoever. But still, we'd have to go in. One of the first questions we need to ask is what equipment was operating? Was it operating normally? Then we need to understand the whole sequence of events. We understand that the vessel moved to the inboard lane to get around the ice, and we do understand that there was some maneuvering in ice. Also during this process they were letting the pilot off, and then it was a short time after that the vessel grounded. But we're going to need to go through that very, very carefully, almost minute by minute, and there'll be a lot of interviewing and a lot of discussions that need to go on, and I suspect the Coast Guard has already started that itself. They had a Coast Guard representative on board from the first thing in the morning. So, you know, as far as I could tell, they may have already started their investigation. I haven't had contact with them. I don't know. The Coast Guard has the immediate authority to use dispersants for this particular area. I think it's called a Zone 1, and the only meaning of the Zone 1 is that the local Coast Guard representative has authority. So he has been preordained to be the one to make that judgment.
This morning, the Coast Guard closed the Port of Valdez when Exxon takes over responsibility to reopen the port.
Oh, no, we can't do that. That stays with the Coast Guard, yes. Yes.
Is it?
It's a we you know, we have an expert here with us, Mr. Gordon Lindblom, and he's one of the experts worldwide on the dispersant application. So, you know, I can have him get back to you.
Powder or liquid?
No.
Is it toxic?
No, it's non-toxic. It's totally non-toxic.
Wait.
I think the EPA agrees with that, clearly.
I just attended an international oil spill conference in San Antonio, Texas. Dispersants were a major topic of conversation. They were also one of the main panel discussions. Another main panel discussion was open water and coastal spills. Dispersants are like joy soap. What they do is they break up the oil on the surface of the water. They make it form into little balls, droplets, and they sink. They sink the oil spill, the entire oil spill off the surface of the water. They put it down into the water column.
Well, I don't think we would agree with that, nor would the world's experts agree with that. But what it does is it interrupts the cohesion of the oil for itself. And it breaks that cohesion.
Right.
Yes.
The droplets form and they go down into the water. The oil goes off the water surface.
No, and I'll tell you how you see that's not the case. If you take a container of oil, a clear container, and you put dispersant in and shake it up, there is no oil anywhere. You've broken the film totally.
It's compartmentalized. There's about four different compartments here. One is, you have mass, and it cannot disappear. What it does is it becomes recompartmentalized. It goes into the air, it goes into the water column, it goes into the sediments, or it goes into the marine organisms. When you disperse, so that you have, if you have 100% oil on one hand, you have to have 100% equal sum. It doesn't disappear. Now, what dispersants do is they put the oil down into the water column, and it makes it extremely toxic for the animals that are within the water column. This is why we're concerned about the fish. When it's on the interface, the surface, the air-water interface, it's more harmful to marine mammals or animals that go back and forth through the water column, through the interface, seabirds, than your marine mammal. When it goes down into the water column, it looks like it's been cleaned up, but in reality what's happening is it's being partitioned into the water column, into the marine organisms in the water column, and into the sediment. Or the tides will carry it out and it will be dispersed. I mean, that's why it's called a dispersant. The problem is, like right now with the herring fishery, fish, there have been studies done, and fish tend to avoid spilled oil. However, when it's in the water column, they can't see it, so they can't avoid it. They pick it up across their gills when they're breathing, when they're breathing the water. It enters their body, and it's partitioned in their body into the fat. That's where it goes when these hydrocarbons tend to be partitioned into the fat, the lipids. This is why we're concerned about right now, because our next fishery is the herring roe fishery, which is the fish eggs, which is where these hydrocarbons are really going. So it's not out of sight, out of mind, which is what I want to point out. Even though dispersants may be applied, this doesn't mean that the problem is going to disappear. It's going to be partitioned in a different compartment.
Let me ask Alan Mackey. Alan is a PhD with Exxon and Anchorage, and he is much more in position to answer the questions than I am. So let me turn the mic over to Alan, if you will.
Before we announce this, I'd like to say that I have a master's in oil pollution and a PhD in sediment pollution, master's in marine biology, and a PhD in fisheries, and I am a commercial fisherman in this area. Thank you.
I don't think we want to enter into a...
On the radio, evidently the decision had been made for this disbursement, and I'm sure that's why there was no booning done of this vessel out there. Now, we've talked about herring, we've talked about the fisheries like this. We have hundreds of millions of salmon fry at this time, which nobody has mentioned.
Which the dispersants would affect.
Leaving the streams in Prince William Sound right now. going out and they stay in this sound, and they can be affected by this dispersement or by the spill. And nobody has mentioned that. Now, this is the production on fake salmon for next year. And the Valdez Arm and the Port of Valdez and areas where this oil is produces somewhere between 15 and 25% of the wild stocks that go out into this Prince William Sound. Now, it's a serious matter because there are literally many, many hundreds of people's livelihoods depending on this process. Now, I feel this disbursement issue was made at about 8 or 8:30 this morning because that's when it came onto the radio. I flew with Chuck LePage at 2:30 this afternoon. There wasn't even a Kleenex in the water to clean up that oil.
I don't think this is the right forum to debate the efficacy of
I'm saying we talked about herring. There's other things involved here, such as hundreds of millions of salmon fry.
I understand your concern, and rest assured, no one's more concerned than we are. Perhaps I could tie together a few of the concerns that have arisen from some of the questions here this evening in the events that have... I'm with the Exxon Anchorage office, and some of us have been on site since this morning.
Governor Cooper has just entered the room and begun to speak.
To avoid the ice that was there, but of course the Coast Guard wasn't on board the vessel to make sure that the course correction they needed to do was the right one.
I thought they had a sophisticated radar to monitor the shipping lane.
Well, I did too.
The question was, didn't the Coast Guard have a radar to monitor? And the governor said he thought so.
Last time we did a measurement, it was about 6 miles by 3 miles. Is that correct, Denny?
Yes, and Doug Lockwood from our staff just returned from another mapping flight. Doug, is that still accurate? 6 by 3.5 or so, or is it moved? Is it larger?
It's probably more out. There's creeks out in the middle of the sound. It's probably out as far as the mass, eight miles by probably 3.5, 4 miles.
Yes, sir.
Again, we apologize that the questions are not audible. We're in a live conference room setting. There are about 100 people, 125 people in the ballroom of the Valdez Civic Center for this press conference. We have microphones on the podium where the speakers, and now the governor, Steve Cooper of Alaska, with Dennis Kelsey, or Kelso, his Commissioner of Environmental Conservation.
People with expertise in cleaning up oil spills, but I can't speak for them. My impression was that that was what they had in mind. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the fact that you have limited amount of money and resources to deal with this problem. They made the statement that they would cover this, so why can't you mobilize your people under those expense accounts?
We are, sir. We have 10 people from DEC here now, which we would do regardless of who was paying the bill. I think what the inquiry was whether we were going to put more full-time people in Valdez for DEC. Parenthetically, I want to say this, that over the last 2 years, when I've been in office, the DEC has in fact been increased, I think, about 20% each year. It was inadequate before. It still is, but it's getting better than it was. John?
What do you think about the special tax zone of oil and gas property to provide municipalities with the ability to protect themselves from incidents like this?
Do you want that kind of authority?
Yeah.
We'll sure give it a thought, give it some thought. Probably we're not going to decide that over here tonight, but worthy of consideration.
Thank you.
Yes. Oh, hi, Sandy. Well, it's important, and actually, it's a real disaster. That's what it is. And I think it's kind of ironic that it happened 25 years to the day from the Good Friday earthquake in 1964. If there are no other questions, yes, sir. Well, I spoke, I came in as soon as I could commandeer an airplane from Fairbanks, and I spoke with the DEC people and others, and then took a float plane out to the Exxon Valdez and went up the Jacob's Ladder. I hadn't done that in some years. It's a real adventure. And spent most of the rest of the afternoon on board the vessel where people had a pretty good idea of what was going on. Spoke with Coast Guard personnel, with some of the Exxon people later on, and mostly with our own DEC people who had an excellent handle on what was going on. Okay. Yes, sir.
Governor, while you were on board, did you question the delay in response and applying a boom or payment?
Again, we're
sir, I would have if, yes, I'd, if there had been somebody on board the vessel to question. That, as I understand it, is an Alyeska responsibility. There was nobody on board from Alyeska. But as I understanding, that's Alyeska's responsibility, and the evidence is that it wasn't discharged very well. And I don't know why. Yes?
Governor, ice seems to have been a possible factor in this accident. When Columbia Glacier first started breaking up, there were a number of research studies done about the effect of ice on the tankers. And some of the companies were not running their tankers at night. This seems to have gone by the way as people have gotten accustomed to Columbia Glacier discharging a lot of ice. Are you going to be asking that this question of ice and moving tankers out at night might be relooked at?
Well, it's one of a whole lot of questions that are going to be asked and answered as a result of this disaster. The Coast Guard has the initial responsibility for the inquiry as to why this took place. We also are going to have an investigation. This is not going to happen again. Once is too many times. We were assured, of course, that it would never happen.
Governor, I'd like to point out, perhaps you've seen the 1988 Marine Casualty Survey study that was done.
No.
That indicated that 13% of the United States flagship tankers are involved with the transport of North Slope crude. That 13% accounts for 52% of the structural failures in this flagship fleet. I really think that we need to look into the tanker that. And okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you. That was not, however, a factor in this particular incident. Actually, the structure was pretty good. If it hadn't been, likely it would have split in half. It was a good vessel.
My point there was, maybe once is too much, but I'm willing to bet you money this won't be the last unless something's done about this. The other thing I'd like, not to complicate the matter, but I would like you to take note of something during the next few days, and that is that the oil throughput coming down the Trans-Alaska pipeline system is going to have to be slowed down for this. And one of the reasons, one of the questions you might keep back in the back of your mind is why, because this is the slowdown in pipeline throughput is going to cost the state, I believe, and it's also, since Alyeska supplies 24% of the United States domestic oil, could almost be viewed as a threat to national security. Why do they have to slow the oil in the pipeline down? Could it be because they only have 18 of the required 32 crude oil storage tanks available at their facility? It's just something to keep in mind. Why do they have to slow down the pipeline throughput? I know they're not getting tankers in, but they should have enough capacity at that terminal to hold the oil. This is going to come up again because the fishermen are going to request an engineering audit of that facility. So I don't mean to complicate the issue, but I'd like you to keep it in mind.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, one more.
The question being asked is if the oil companies won't apparently take the initiative to stockpile equipment in Valdez, can the state require the oil companies to stockpile spill response equipment in the Port Valdez area? Again, many of the questions raised tonight are by members of the Alaska commercial fishing community, and they are certainly concerned. The governor's now responding. Again, it's difficult to hear the questions that are being asked. It's a large hall, and again, there are about 125 people here in the ballroom in the Valdez Civic Center. Governor Dennis Kelsey, the DC commissioner, is responding.
But let me answer a couple of parts of it and see if I get enough of it. There are at least two issues in there. One is, does the state have the authority to require the right kind of contingency planning? And do we have the authority to make sure it actually gets carried out? After the Cook Inlet oil spill, which was small in volume, important in impact, but small in volume, we took a very hard look at that, did a postmortem of that spill, and the governor requested legislation to correct some shortfalls in the state's authority. That legislation was enacted into law, and as a result of that, we now have the ability to require adequate contingency plans, not only of shore-based facilities, but also of vessels, and to require that those facilities or vessels actually be able to demonstrate the capability of carrying out the plans that they submitted to us. So now we have that authority. If we're looking at a situation such as in the harbor here, there you have a set of variables that are relatively straightforward to predict. Now, not entirely, but they're a lot easier to predict than if you have a vessel running aground or breaking up, not in port. The kind of contingency plan that you would have for normal operations or for a spill that occurs in normal operations is really a very different kind of creature than what you have to have available if you have a catastrophic spill such as this one, which was really not just a spill. We're talking about a grounding of a large vessel that then ruptured and spilled the contents in that way. So that the oil spill contingency plans are designed to deal with many kinds of spills, but are not necessarily crafted for this particular kind of event. Then the question is, how quickly can the available resources be mobilized and put into place so you minimize the effect from this kind of a situation? I think we're going to want to take a hard look at how well that mobilization occurred. As the governor mentioned, often right at the beginning of a spill is when you have the best chance of containing it, and we need to know more about what happened in this instance.
Again, there's a follow-up question to the commissioner relating to the availability of fishermen and other people in the community at the early hours of this morning to attempt a response, and the apparent reluctance of the response team led by Alaska and the Coast Guard to accept those offers.
Well, I think that's your point about needing to get an immediate and adequate first response is a very good point. And
nothing was done for so long.
obviously, we have some more questions to ask about that.
Thank you very much.
Governor Steve Cooper is leaving the podium now, and I think that that pretty much signals the conclusion of this press conference. We'll be grabbing a few folks if we can. If you can grab the governor in Evansville. The governor and the commissioner of environmental conservation have left the podium. Exxon left a while ago. In fact, it was kind of odd. The Exxon people left about the time the governor came in. There was a meeting, a response team meeting that the governor was required, that the Exxon president of Exxon Shipping, Jack Irasi, was required to attend. The questioning was fast and furious from members of the primarily the fishing community. Ricky Ott from CDFU and UFA in Cordova led the questioning. There were others as well, including some of the Valdez labor force, so union representatives and such, wanting to know if local labor would be hired and if the local resources would be mobilized to deal with this situation. This has been a special presentation of KCHU Radio. We're here at the Valdez Civic Center. There was a press conference put on by the Exxon company and then sort of taken over by CDFU spokesman Ricky Ott and then passed on to Governor Cooper and Commissioner of Environmental Conservation Dennis Kelso. We'll be standing by here. We may have be able to grab someone for a brief word, but for this moment, this is Dave Hammack reporting from the Valdez Civic Center and telling KCHU to stand by, but for the time being, take it away.
Thank you, Dave. We will be carrying any of the latest information that we can bring you right here on KCHU Valdez. Oops, we go back to the Civic Center with another update from Dave Hammack.
It was quite an event, started out with Exxon and almost taken over by Ricky Ott from CDFU, and then the baton was passed to Governor Cooper and the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. Governor, you did spend quite a bit of time this afternoon on the vessel. Is the scene organized, chaotic? What's your impressions as to just what is being done out on the Exxon Valdez?
Well, on the Exxon Valdez, of course, at the moment, there's nothing to do. It's just sitting there. Obviously, there was a mistake made on the way out of the terminal. There was a navigation error there, and the ship became moored on a charted reef, which is pretty hard to do, I think. But nevertheless, it was done. We lost the vessel lost about 260,000 barrels of oil. The largest spill ever in the history of Alaska, one of the largest ever in the history of the world. The response was, as I said in the press conference, inadequate, and it was not timely. It should have been done quicker, and it should have been done much more efficiently by Alyeska. All the evidence points to that. Now we have oil floating on the water in a patch that's probably somewhere around 7 or 8 miles long and about 4 miles wide.
We did some quick calculations here and they came out to about 32 square miles.
A lot of water, a lot of oil, and we're trying to figure out how to get that oil away from the shore without poisoning all the fish. You can drop chemicals on the oil and it breaks it up, sends it down to the bottom, but that chemical is toxic to marine life. So we've got a couple of real tough choices to make.
Governor, the response made several times by Exxon Shipping President Jack Irasi to certain questions about the response. He referred to the response team and the authority of the Coast Guard or Alyeska and whatnot. Even at the just beginning to look at what has happened in response, one begins to see this incredible morass of perhaps overlapping jurisdictions.
Right.
You've got federal agencies, state agencies, various oil companies, and just within the government, department after department, all involved. Is your sense of it that the state, whether it's the governor's office or DEC, really has a big enough handle right now to wade into this bureaucratic quagmire and make sure things are being done?
Well, you know, we don't have the authority to come in and do what's necessary. By law, Alyeska has the first response. If that response is inadequate and not timely, as was the case this time, then everybody's in a mess. The Coast Guard has primary jurisdiction. The DEC has jurisdiction over certain aspects of it. It was a plan that was worked out in the U.S. Congress, and like a lot of plans worked out in the U.S. Congress, it doesn't work when the time comes, and this is what you get.
You flew down from Fairbanks today. Will you be leaving Valdez, or will you be hanging around any longer?
Well, no, I'm on my way back to Fairbanks as soon as you let me sign off here. I've got an airplane out there waiting and a tired pilot.
I've never had a chance to keep the governor's airplane waiting before. We want to thank you for speaking with us. And as I said earlier, it's sorry that it took this event to have you back on KCHU. Any thoughts as far as what DEC's priorities will be in the next 24 or 48 hours?
Well, of course, it's pretty clear that DEC's priority is going to be to do whatever it can to keep the oil from hitting the beach. And we're going to have to use some chemicals on the oil, but we want to do it in a way that has the least possible impact on the marine environment. That's about as good as I can do at the moment.
Given the the friction happening right now in Juneau as the legislature and the governor's office try to sort out next year's budget problems, are we going to be able, do we have the reserve sufficient to respond to the situation in the way the state would like to?
Well, it's not so much money as it is requiring the responsible parties to have the ability to respond quickly. They said they did, but when the time came, the response wasn't timely and the oil got loose. That's what it amounts to. And it's really a matter of requiring people to do this in a responsible way.
Well, thank you very much, Governor Cooper. We appreciate you coming down. And that was Governor Steve Cooper speaking with us here at the Valdez Civic Center. And as the governor and his entourage head toward the door, the room definitely is clearing. And I think that will be our last report at this time from the Valdez Civic Center. We'll be signing on the air tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock instead of KCH's usual 8 o'clock leisurely Saturday morning sign-on. We'll be able to hopefully update reports on what has been happening and what will transpire overnight. Again, the Exxon shipping president, Jackie Rossi, who is here as a head of the Exxon response team, predicting that the equipment that has been mobilized around the world will be arriving in the early hours tomorrow, some 30 hours after the spill first occurred, the incident on with the Exxon Valdez. At that time, we do hope again to have an update as to what the status is. We'll have early morning flyovers. We'll try to get reports for on those as well. And with that, finally, after conversations with the governor, the room is emptying. This is Dave Hammack reporting from the Valdez Civic Center and returning you to the KCHU studios.